ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. And we finish out our John Dahl tribute as guest Lauren Humphreys Brooks joins me once again to look at Dahl's performance in the gritty 1950 noir Gun Crazy.
Our great star act. Ladies and gentlemen, as owner and manager of Packets Carnival, it is I myself who present to you the famous, the dangerous, the beautiful Miss Sandy Laurie Starr, direct from London, England, and the capitals of the continent, before whose remarkable marksmanship the greatest pistol and rifle shots in America have gone down to defeat. So, here she is, ladies and gentlemen, so appealing, so dangerous, so lovely to look at, the darling of London, England, Miss Annie Laurie Starr.
Despite his top billing in 1948's Rope, which we discussed in the last episode, John Dahl was never given significant opportunities to capitalize on it. By 1950, he was still trotting the boards of Broadway and entering the uncharted waters of television. Much of what put Dahl on the road to making Gun Crazy revolves around the creation of the script itself. The idea for the movie started with the King brothers, Frank and Maurice, who had worked with Poverty Row studios like Monogram before going independent in 1947. The two saw a story in the Saturday Evening Post and came up with the idea of two love-struck sharpshooters on the run. After hearing about screenwriter Dalton Trumbo's contempt of court charge during his HUAC testimony, the King brothers offered him $3,750 to be paid over 18 months to adapt a story written by McKinley Cantor based on that article. The finished product was attributed to Cantor and Miller Kaufman, but Kaufman was a front to keep Trumbo out of trouble. He hoped that it would compel MGM to reinstate his contract after he had been blacklisted. But unfortunately, this wasn't the case, and Trumbo would be barred from having his name on his scripts for several years. The finished product was 375 pages long, which is about 5 hours of screen time, and went to Joseph H. Lewis. Lewis had worked in Hollywood since the 1920s, where he started as a camera assistant. He received a directing contract from Universal in 1937, where his penchant for creating unique camera angles, especially ones seen through the spokes of a wagon wheel, earned him the nickname Wagon Wheel Joe. And much of what you watch in Gun Crazy, the unique camera angles and the shooting from the back of a Cadillac, is attributed to Lewis's unique eye. Up until the 1970s, Lewis maintained he never knew Trumbo had written the script, though this remains in doubt. The script then threw some changes to please the code, such as marrying its leads, Bart and Annie Laurie, before they go on their crime spree, but before you know it, it was ready to go before cameras.
$40 a week?
We can get by on that.
Yeah, maybe you can, but not me. It's too slow, Bart. I want to do a little living.
What's your idea of living?
It's not $40 a week.
Tell me, when did you get this idea?
Oh, I've always had it. Ever since I can remember. If I don't get it one way, I'll get it the other.
I didn't think we'd had it figured out that way.
Well, so I've changed my mind. I told you I was no good. I didn't kid you, did I? Well, now you know. But I've been kicked around all my life. And from now on, I'm going to start kicking back.
Now, since the feature only has two leads, it would stand to reason that casting would be fairly simple. And where other films offer a part to multiple actresses, Gun Crazy isn't one of them. Joseph Lewis was said to have offered Veronica Lake the part of the villainous femme fatale Annie Laurie Starr, but she turned him down. Instead, it was British actress Peggy Cummins who was offered the role after Lewis screened footage of her in the 1947 period drama Forever Amber. Now, if you're saying, Kristen, Peggy Cummins isn't in Forever Amber, you would be correct. The role of Annie Laurie was a balm for Cummins, as 20th Century Fox was in the process of terminating her contract, presumably after the failure of her film Moss Rose. The studio ended up replacing Cummins in Forever Amber with Linda Darnell, and Cummins took on the role of the sensuous sharpshooter in Gun Crazy. As for Dahl, there's nothing to prove or disprove he wasn't Lewis's only choice for the role of Bart. Lewis himself controversially said he cast Dahl because Dahl was homosexual and projected an inner weakness. Other critics have gone on to say that Lewis wasn't implying Dahl was weak because he was gay, but more the sense that his marginalization aided in his performance. Regardless of all that, Dahl did receive good notices for his performance, though it still never quite translated to leading man stardom.
Hi.
Well, it's a nice getup.
I like it.
Good-looking gun.
thanks.
That's English, ain't it?
That's right.
What show are you with?
Cheyenne, Rodeo, and Carnival. The rest will be coming through in a few minutes. I got too far out in front.
You gonna play here?
No.
Well, it's an easy town on shows. Three tickets, you've covered the whole police force.
That's a pretty nice gun you got, too.
I'm sorry. I don't let anybody handle it. I killed a man with it last year.
Did he have it coming to him?
Yes, but it wasn't much fun watching him get down. He had an idea he was getting the first shot.
The King Brothers story of Boy Meets Gun was greeted with enthusiasm by United Artists, who wanted to eliminate the film's pulpy B-quality veneer with a presumably new and improved title. So when they released it, it was under the name Deadly is the Female in the middle of 1950. Reviews were middling and audiences just didn't turn out. Lewis actually blamed the title, which he believed took away the film's unique identity, and honestly, he's not wrong. I mean, what would you rather go see, a movie called Gun Crazy or Deadly is the Female? In August of the same year, Lewis demanded a re-release under the original title of Gun Crazy, but by that point, the theaters really weren't keen on screening a film that had already had its due and voted against it. The Little Picture held its own, though, becoming a landmark in film noir. In 1998, it was selected by the Library of Congress for preservation and has received rave reviews from critics who have discovered it decades later. In 1994, when director Peter Bogdanovich interviewed Joseph Lewis, Lewis praised the film, saying, quote, $400,000 and 30 days of shooting time to put together a movie that had withstood the test of time. And as for John Dahl, yeah, things weren't too great for him, although he did do a lot more work on Broadway and television, but films just weren't his thing. He ended up passing away at the age of 52. After the break, Lauren Humphreys Brooks joined me as we go a little gun crazy.
I'll hawk my guns. Give us enough dough to make another start.
There isn't enough money in those guns for the kind of start I want. But I want things, a lot of things, big things. I don't want to be afraid of life or anything else. I want a guy with spirit and guts. A guy who can laugh at anything, who'll do anything. A guy who can kick over the traces and win the world for me.
Look, I don't want to look in that mirror and see nothing but a stick-up man staring back at me.
You better kiss me goodbye, Bart. Because I won't be here when you get back.
Welcome back, listeners. We continue our look at actor John Dahl by discussing the other movie that he is best known for, which is 1950's Gun Crazy, a very different movie from 1948's Rope. This is directed by Joseph H. Lewis, written by McKinley Cantor and Millard Kaufman, although Millard Kaufman is actually a front for Dalton Trumbo, who is credited with the screenplay. It stars John Dahl and Peggy Cummins as two lovers who engage in a crime spree in order to get the life that at least one of them believes they deserve. Once again, I'm joined by the wonderful and amazing Lauren Humphreys Brooks. Lauren, how are you?
I'm pretty good.
I'm excited to talk to you about Gun Crazy because up until yesterday, I had never seen this movie. I had been told to, but I had not gotten to it. What was your background with this prior to recording?
I think I've seen this film three times now, and the first time around I saw it, I think because it had been recommended to me as being this important seminal film noir. I don't think I've seen anything else that Lewis has directed. And then I remember turning this on and being like, oh, it's the guy from Rope, which is the only time that I'd ever seen John Dahl. So I was like, oh, this is very exciting. Of course, it's a very different part for him. But I've always enjoyed this film. I liked it the first time I saw it. Some of the camera work in it is just amazing. And I really like the two central performances. It's a combination of sun-soaked and gritty noir, which I quite like a lot. There's a sense of real life happening.
This is a movie that I think if you have been raised on A-list noirs, you're going to be a bit taken aback. Because I had never seen this, and it's a very different noir in terms of tone, in terms of acting. It's very naturalistic. Technically, this is a take two recording, and you had mentioned previously that there's a lot of location-based filmmaking, which is different. Joseph Lewis does a lot of really interesting things with the camera that gives this voyeuristic look in a way that's very different from Rope. And the performances are very gritty. Aside from John Dahl and Peggy Cummins, everybody looks like actual people. And really, John Dahl, if you thought he didn't have A-list good looks, Here, he just looks like an average guy. I think that it's very easy to see why he wasn't a bigger name, because he just looks like a regular guy. And Hollywood, I think at that time, was like, we don't want that. This reminds me a lot of Detour, because Detour is one of those where it really had to sit with me in order for me to understand whether I liked it or not, because it is 90 minutes or less of watching terrible people do terrible things. And here, even though one of the characters has a conscience compared to the other, really, a lot of this is just based on animal instincts. These two are really horny for each other. And every decision they make is motivated by being turned on in some way. And I think that's very different from the way sex is utilized in something like Double Indemnity, where it just feels like it's bubbling beneath the surface, but you're not really clear if they engage in it. I was gonna say Out of the Past. Out of the Past, there's no denying that those two definitely have sex. Here, you're not convinced that they're not gonna just start having sex while they're actually robbing somebody. I mean, it's like that.
Well, and maybe it's because that this is a B movie and that this is being distributed through Monogram Pictures. There's a little bit of a looseness to some of the censorship to it that you probably couldn't get away with, even in 1950 in Hollywood in a more A-list film. Because of that, you get much more, like I was saying, get much grittier. I said earlier, I'll say it again, that it's very reminiscent of films like Kiss Me Deadly, the Mike Hammer noir, which is much lower budgeted, it's more violent, it's more sexual. It's all of the stuff that, like, the moral majority kind of objected to in the 1950s, just like, this is ruining our children. And Gun Crazy is very much in that vein. I was interested in the fact that I hadn't realized that Dalton Trumbo wrote the screenplay for this, which sort of gives it another interesting layer. And Trumbo, even in the screenplays that he was credited with, before he was blacklisted, there's always that sense of trying to push the envelope just a little bit, of really doubling down on things like drawing the parallels between these two people having a relationship with violence and a relationship with sex, and particularly the gun. And the gun is like this sexual instrument, this phallic instrument. And that's very interesting in this film. And it comes up in other movies, but this one really does push that.
There's been several Lovers on the Run type of movies, and I would say that Bonnie and Clyde, which was made in 67, owes its life to this movie. Bonnie and Clyde is more of a remake of Gun Crazy than it actually is a biopic of Bonnie and Clyde. But you've seen this type of story done before in stuff like Fritz Lang's You Only Live Once, or Nicholas Ray's They Live by Night. They've done it since with Sam Peckinpah's The Getaway, or Badlands, or Oliver Stone with Natural Born Killers. And here, especially in comparison to something like You Only Live Once, which is one I've seen recently, there's this moral majority to it that the characters know right versus wrong. And here, that's not really the case. They understand right versus wrong, and at least the Peggy Cummins character doesn't care about that. But you brought up sex and violence, which is what we talked about last time with Rope. It's all about sex and death. But here I think it's more overt with the presence of guns, which you mentioned was a phallic object. I'm not exaggerating. This movie is all about these two wanting to have sex with each other. I mean, the minute they meet, the camera's just looking at John Dahl's face. Or when they go up to do the shooting contest at the beginning, and they just are, like, stalking around each other, looking at each other, and she shoots the gun between her legs, and you're like,
it's
come
not
on,
subtle.
Man. There is not a lot of subtlety at all. Every scene has a sexual negotiation, from the way that Lori is negotiating them robbing this bank, and she's in the robe, and the implication is that she's nude, to when they're talking about going to find a parking space for the bank. I mean, you're reading every line as if it's sexually suggestive. And compared to Rope, how do we think the chemistry between the two leads here works, or does it work?
I do think that it works. You get the sense that it's very actually similar to some of the things that Godard and Truffaut did later. This sort of mad love, basically. They're destructive for each other, and probably the most damaging thing that they could have done for either of their lives was to be together. But they have to be together. They have to have this outlet. And the thing is, for the most part, they get married pretty early on in the film. So the implication is that they are having sex. They are, like, quote, legally. So they don't have to necessarily get off on firing guns or anything like that. But that is the way that they get off. That is what they're into, particularly her. give props to Peggy Cummins. She is into this character. She is so obviously gets such a thrill out of being a sadist, which is, of course, very different from Rope, where the John Dahl character is the one who gets a thrill out of being a sadist. So I get the sense that actually Brandon and Laurie would have probably gotten along pretty well. They both are on the same wavelength.
I was going to say, I think that they would probably try to kill each other numerous times, but it would be amazing. The femme fatale is always one of those women that has the upper hand. You always believe in the noir world, and it happens for almost all noirs, is that the men are not thinking with their head up north. They're thinking with their crotch. Here, that's the literal manifestation. You never believe that Bart has any control over any of this. He's almost like a drug addict in a lot of ways. And at one point, they do try to separate. And he is the one that leaves his car to go back to be with her. It's not the other way around. So every time she says in this movie that she loves him, I never believe it. Because there's really no way to prove that in a relationship where the movie makes no bones about the fact that it is one-sided. There's an attraction between her and him, but I never believe that she actually gives a crap about him. I believe that he's just really convenient. He goes along with whatever she says.
I kind of disagree with you on that. I think that he's convenient, but she needs him at some level, because if he was just convenient, she could easily leave him at any point. Right? And it is an S&M relationship almost, where she's very much in power, she's very much in control, but she's not trying to lead him astray in the sense of, so like, in Double Indemnity, right? The whole point of that is that the Barbara Sandler character has gotten a hold of this guy who she can basically convince to murder her husband, or to help her murder her husband. And she knows that, and so there's a deliberateness to that. In this one, I don't think that she looks at him and goes like, oh, this is my ticket to escape or anything like that. I think she just looks at him just like, this is exactly what I want and this is exactly what I need. And so that's a kind of love. It's not a deep romantic love. I don't think it's like that he's deeply romantically in love with her in the way that we usually define it. That's why I said mad love. They are violently in love with each other to the degree that they will destroy one another before the end of it. Very much like Bonnie and Clyde.
There's a moment where you find out she has another guy that she's been with, which is the guy that runs the carnival that she works at. And you're never clear if she's brought this guy into a life of crime or if he was into that before. I mean, you're never really sure, but the implication is that this relationship is played out before. The only difference is that they haven't found a way to settle down and at least make some sort of living out of it. The Laurie character is very interesting because you're never given a real glimpse into her background. I mean, she mentions she's from England. Peggy Cummins herself was English, so I think they needed a way to hide any slip of the accent. That her father, they lived by the sea at a certain point, but you're never really sure what has brought her to be this dissolute figure. I think that's interesting in a landscape where women, especially as the 50s would happen, are becoming more of this domestic angel in the house type of thing, to use the Victorian term. You see this a lot in, like, juvenile delinquent movies. You're like, how does a nice girl like this become this, like, unrepentant figure? Well, we're never really sure. From the sounds of it, she's had this really nice childhood. To audiences of the 50s, that's what makes it more dangerous.
I think that it's briefly mentioned, I would have to check the film again, but I do think that it's mentioned that her father owned a shooting gallery. Which
that's
is
right,
basically
right,
there
did.
For explanation as to why she's such a sharpshooter, why she's so good at it. At some level, it makes sense that Bart is a sharpshooter because he's a boy, like he grew up with guns, all of that kind of thing. But it's less, where does she come from? It's interesting because we do get a lot of Bart's backstory and what he was into and why he is the way that he is. Whereas with her, like you're saying, we're introduced to her and we get very, very little background. It is more psychological at that level. There's something that's in her that this is providing her an outlet or an escape, much in the same way that some of the other women of film noir, like it's a trope that the woman who wants to escape a bad marriage, usually to an older man, which is kind of in play here with the original carnival barker that she's involved with up until she runs it to Bart. So you get some of that. Now there's something psychologically going on with this young woman that she needs this kind of violence as an outlet for whatever, like, she's getting off on this. It isn't just an escape, in other words.
What's also telling is how Bart is the central protagonist, but the gender roles are really swapped in this movie in a way that I think is supposed to be intentional. The fact that he is interested in guns, but he doesn't want to kill. She always talks about how she wants a man with guts who can give her action. Again, the words are very loaded with sexual innuendo. The concept of, like, masculinity. And we saw this with Rope, that the characters there wanted to assert their masculinity and thus their superiority over another man of their strata. And here you have the Bart character who is masculine up to a degree. And whether the fact that he won't kill, does that make him less of a man? And where does the gender lines, as we have commonly come to know them, especially in the 50s, everything feels very blurred.
That whole thing, he's a pacifist who loves guns. I really like the notion of to begin with, because there's this whole thing that, like, he goes into the army. He's a brilliant sharpshooter, but he won't kill anything. And it's explained that the reason why he won't was when he was a little kid and he got his first gun, he shot a chick and was just brokenhearted over it, and that he's never killed anything since. If you want to tease out the sexual connotations to the very end, it's basically like he can't follow through. And then it raises up, like, issues of his sexuality and, like, this idea that he can't get it off, basically.
Which you also see with Bonnie and Clyde, which I think is a good segue there. I'm a big fan of Arthur Penn's Bonnie and Clyde, mostly because it has two of the most beautiful leads. I mean, it's Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway, and I don't really know who to look at in that movie. There are a lot of similarities, a lot more similarities than I anticipated, because both of them are essentially supposed to be Bonnie and Clyde's stories. You have the biggest giveaway is the wardrobe. Peggy Cummins wears the beret, which is what Bonnie and Clyde pretty much made famous. A lot of claustrophobic scenes in the car. Only Arthur Penn, you get a lot of front-facing stuff to show how many people are in the car, and here Joseph H. Lewis is actually filming from the back of the car. There's a scene where John Dahl's Bart says that he's reading about funerals.
Yeah.
And there is a scene in Bonnie and Clyde where they take Gene Wilder's character, who's an undertaker, and the whole implication of them being able to know that their deaths are coming. And of course, the sexuality angle. Bonnie and Clyde, Warren Beatty's character, which is probably the most laughable part of the movie, is the fact that he's impotent. And aside from the fact that I don't buy that for a second, because it's Warren Beatty, but what I think this movie does better in a way that Bonnie and Clyde is just so cool. It makes them like Robin Hood figures, almost. It's just so cool to be in this car with Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway and their berets and eating hamburgers, and it's such fun until it's not. Bart and Laurie are always on the knife's edge. You know, they're always one step away from just losing it all. So much of their decision-making is almost flawed from the get-go. I mean, when they stop at the one bank and the cop is walking out front and she gets out to talk to him. Right as he comes out of the bank, she has to, like, do that karate chop, which I was like, really? We know karate now, okay. I also like the costuming a little bit better here because I am a sucker for, like, old-timey Western wear. They wear a lot of that here. But I think that where this is different is Bonnie and Clyde, even though it's set in the turn of the century, it feels very, very 1967. Here, the movie, I think, really wants to evoke the Old West. Again, that whole idea of the cowboy hero, the outlaw, from the way they dress to the way they act, and showing that that lifestyle is literally coming to a close as the 50s would start. And you see this move towards fearing communism, fearing conformity, fearing the suburbs, that this manifest destiny and this idea of the idyllic outlaw is passé.
It is about freedom, and in much the same way that Bonnie and Clyde is about freedom. The only way for us to be free is to live outside of the laws. And you see that with her particularly because she has more of a vested interest in living outside of that because she's female. Because there are only so many roles that she can occupy. So she gets married, and it's just like, okay, now what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to settle down, move to the suburbs, have a bunch of kids, have the white picket fence, all of that stuff. And that's sort of what the post-war era, really, is meant to evoke. She not only won't do that, it would kill her. And so her escape, her form of freedom, is to become, like you're saying, this Wild West outlaw, basically. To play that role. That ultimately is also going to kill her, but there's no other escape.
Well, I think Poor John Dahl gets overshadowed by her in this movie because she's really great. We gotta talk about her a little bit more. I love how she's introduced with that gunshot to the camera, which I think is really great. This was actually her last Hollywood film. She only did a couple, and then I think she went back to England and made movies there. And I think she did just recently pass away in December of last year at the age of 92. So not a huge career. She did a couple films. She was in the Dane Andrews movie, Curse of the Demon. She only had 28 credits to her name. Gun Crazy is probably her best known film. But she's got this animal nature to her, the way she's always like clutching on John Dahl, the way she's looking at the camera. It's a very different acting style from like a Barbara Stanwyck or a Jane Greer, these characters that always look very put together. And I like her because she's so different. She's not on the same spectrum as like an Anne Savage, to use Detour again, which is the grittiest of gritty femme fatales, but she's not Jean Tierney in Leave Her to Heaven. She's a very interesting combination of femme fatales of the time. What do you think?
She's very elemental, and I think you said animalistic. Like, there is this almost primal energy that is underneath all of that, that she's really just pushing back against everything that is expected of her. But there's a wonderful shot where she turns around to look behind them as they're fleeing, and she just gets this look of absolute maniacal glee on her face. And she says, no, they're not chasing us. But you get the sense of like, but maybe they are. And it doesn't really matter to her because she really wants to kill someone. She really wants to hurt somebody. This is what she's getting into. It really is down to her performance, because all you see is just her hanging on his arm and looking over his shoulder and seeing that look on her face. And you realize he doesn't see that. He never really sees that intensity in her that the audience is now being privy to. And it's brilliant moment and absolutely terrifying. So I think it's really the first moment you realize that this woman is psychotic.
It's worth pointing out, Joseph Lewis wanted Veronica Lake to play this character. That would have been very different.
That would have been very different.
Most people who know me know, I think Veronica Lake could have played anything. I don't think she would have been very good here. For starters, I think she was older than John Dahl by a significant margin. She would have been 28. But I think by 1950, Veronica was in the dregs of her career. I don't think it would have elevated her career, but I think it would have given it a far more enduring light in the 50s. Because as the 50s came through, Veronica really, really struggled to this sad end. It would have been interesting. I think it would have been the final film that she'd probably have been remembered for, but I think she would have been horribly miscast. Because if you look at Veronica in noirs that she did at the time, stuff like The Blue Dahlia and This Gun for Hire, which by that point she had not made a noir. Her last noir was 1946, so she had not made another noir in like 4 years. She's always played the very polished, prim. She can double cross, but it comes from this innocent little girl type of mentality. And that's not her fault, that's the fact that she was like barely 5 feet, and she looked very young. She's not intimidating. That's the thing. She's not intimidating. Joseph Lewis probably saw something like This Gun for Hire, where she's doing the magic and stuff, and was like, she could do sharp shooting. I think you need a woman with a bit more presence to her. Peggy Cummins steps into a room, and she's just got this intensity to her. Veronica, you don't get that. It would have been nice to see her try something like this. It's a shame she didn't get to, but I don't think that this would have been the right role for her.
It would have been a very different part. I'm struggling to even imagine her in this part, because you're right, she's so cool. She just would have given off a completely different vibe, and it might have worked. It might have worked, but it would have been a much more understated film in general, because you would have had Dahl, who is a fairly understated character here. Combined with her, it just would have been much quieter in some ways. It might have worked. I have no idea. I think it would have been interesting just to see. I always want to see these kinds of things happen. I'm like, okay, so can you like make both films? Like make this film and then we can compare it with that one. And we'll see who plays the part the most interestingly,
yeah,
or how the role changes.
It's worth pointing out too that this film's alternate title was Deadly is the Female. Compared to other noirs where I mentioned that men aren't really thinking straight in noirs, all noirs. Most of them, though, have this concept of, mostly I think of like Fred McMurray, where he's sitting there thinking about how the woman did it, the woman did it. I don't get the blame game necessarily from this movie. I mean, yes, Laurie is the one compelling Bart to do these things, but there are moments where you start to question whether Bart is just, like, naturally into this. I don't feel that, like, he could say, she's the reason I am this way.
No, and part of that is because we get his mentality before he actually meets her. We see so much of him, and we see, like, him going to juvie because he steals a gun, him being obsessed with guns, him coming out of the army. And while you get the sense that maybe there's a different path that this guy's life might have taken if he hadn't met her, there's a fatalistic turn to it. It's very much headed in this direction. This is the person that he is eventually going to become, almost no matter what he does. So there's a sense that she goads him into crime, but he enters into it with both eyes open. This is not Fred McMurray being conned into murdering Barbara Stanwyck's husband. This isn't John Garfield and Lana Turner in Postman Always Rings Twice. It's not her dragging him kicking and screaming via her intense sexuality. It's very much like, oh, this is something that we need to do now because we're broke.
This is the reminder that I love John Garfield and I still need to see Postman because I haven't
done it
yet.
That's his most iconic role.
I know, I'm working with what has been on TCM, and that has not been on TCM yet. TCM people, I'm hoping, are listening. Schedule that so that I can watch it. You brought up other noirs. What I noticed specifically is that there's a moment where Bart and Laurie, it's like snowing, they're in this little hovel, and she's like upset, and he talks about how if this is how she imagined it, their relationship. And it reminded me that the movies, all movies, not even noirs, but most movies end with the couple getting together and then the credits come. It's a moment that made me think of something like The Graduate, where Dustin Hoffman and Catherine Ross are sitting on the bus at the end, and they're like contemplating, like, did I just make a horrible mistake? And here when Bart asks Laurie if this is how she imagined their relationship would be, it reminds you of how movies really end on this notion of hope, or even noirs end on this whole concept of death is coming for you. Bart's just reminding her about the sad realities of relationships, which is that you struggle. Sometimes you stay in really crappy places and you have no money. I thought that was worth pointing out. Movies often end before this stuff even has to be thought about.
Yeah, although a lot of noirs do tease out the fact that these kinds of relationships that are based primarily on sex and violence, as most noir romances are, do and usually end badly, especially if you resort to murder. This is partially because of the censorship code in the United States, and if you resort to murder, you have to be punished for it. So it's not atypical, I guess, in noir. And a great example is Double Indemnity, to keep on using them. These people are not going to save each other in the end. They're not going to run off to Mexico and be happy. It just isn't going to happen. And you know at some level it isn't. And it goes back to that fatalism of the entire film. I don't know if some of the French filmmakers were later inspired by this film, but it certainly has those elements. Some of Godard's films have the same attitude of, this is insane, and this is fatalistic, and this is how it is going to end, because it's the way that destiny has ordained it, basically. There's no other way it can end. I kind of like that about this film, that they do just both go into it being, we're going to destroy ourselves. Let's go for it.
As the 50s start up, you get the rise of the juvenile delinquent movie, which is also acting as this stark reminder to parents more than anybody. You know, this is what your children are doing. It's funny because I was watching this and I watched Old Yeller for another podcast right around the same time. And my co-host probably was a little surprised that I brought it up. And I'm watching this. There's a scene in this movie where little Russ Tamblyn, who plays young Bart, is sitting in a schoolhouse with a gun in his hand, telling all the children about how he got it and how it's amazing. And the teacher just comes in and she's like, you need to give me the gun. And he's like, no, I'm not. And I was sitting there thinking, God, remember the days? I don't even know if there were days. This might just be movie fantasy playing out. Maybe there never was a day. Remember the day where the concept of a young man walking into a school with a gun wasn't terrifying? He has morals.
It is a weird moment. I mean, at least looked at with modern eyes. I would really like to know how the 1950s reacted to it, because that moment I was just like, he's like playing with a six shooter in the middle of a classroom. And all the kids are like, oh, that's really cool. It's like, no, it's not. This is not okay. He's like 14 years old.
if there's any old listeners that remember watching this movie when it came out, I would love to know how that was responded to. You look at movies with older characters. I think of stuff like The Wild One or Rebel Without a Cause. Violence is really the sad nadir for the characters. Something in like Rebel Without a Cause, the death of Plato, spoiler alert if you don't know the end of Rebel Without a Cause, because he has this gun and it's this moment where he wants to be a man and that ends up proving only that he's a little boy. Whereas here, young Bart sees this gun as a 14-year-old is like something to be proud of. He wants to be a man, and I think his sister brings up the fact that there is no man at home. She's got a fiance that she's gonna marry, and the judge is, you don't need to adopt him, send him to a reform school, he'll be fine. And then you get the apotheosis of the juvenile delinquent in the 60s with West Side Story. This concept that like kids bring on violence because they don't really understand the consequences of it. So where do you think watching this movie fits or does it fit in the whole juvenile delinquent subgenre that popped up?
I mean, it does. And in the moralistic way, in that violence begets violence. So he's obsessed with instruments of violence. They try to direct that in some way. So first, the judge is basically like, no, you can't break into places and steal guns. There has to be a consequence for this.
He says you can like shooting, that's fine, but you can't actually steal. And I was sitting there thinking, that's a really interesting argument there, Judge.
Well, it's interesting given in the 1950s with America's relationship to guns and gun culture that his interest in guns isn't bad. It's the fact that he misuses them and that he's taking it too far, as it were. And so what ultimately happens to him is that they send him to reform school, and it seems to work. He ends up going into the army and training other sharpshooters. So he's directing that intense interest in weaponry into socially acceptable channels, finally, and then he meets Laurie and winds up directing it in less socially acceptable channels. I mean, you can read almost a criticism of gun culture in general in that he's so obsessed with this as evidence of his manhood, but he's also unable to use it for what guns are actually used for, which is to kill things. It's this undirected desire, basically. And then when he meets this woman, he directs it, and he directs it in the direction of using it to kill things. He kills people. He commits robberies. He goes against the legal system. This is the direction that juvenile delinquents are going to go into. And it's very depressing, actually, in its own way, because that entire scene in the courtroom where they're saying, like, he's not a bad kid, and he isn't. And he's not a bad person as a man, either. It's just this obsession of his that has no other direction winds up completely consuming him and eventually killing him because he doesn't have any place else to let it go.
We should talk briefly before we close out about John Dahl. This is the last movie most people would know him for. He did some other things after this. He really embraced television more than anything else. He was, again, supposed to do a lot more stuff after this movie, but nothing ever really panned out. So he starred in one other movie after this called The Man Who Cheated Himself. That was it for a decade. He did a lot of television, he did a lot of plays, and then he came back for a brief role in Spartacus, and then he did his final movie, Atlantis: The Lost Continent, in 1961. He was on Perry Mason for a couple of years, and then that was it. And then he died very early at the age of 52 in the early 70s. He has range. I think if you are saying that the guy who played Brandon in Rope also played this character, that proves his acting ability, because they're two very different characters. And watching it here, he does have this very sweet sensibility. He's very charming, and he has this ability to be romantic. I think my thing, which is why I don't think he ever really became a big star, is the fact that he's in this weird limbo. He doesn't have the looks of someone like a Cary Grant. He just is very nondescript, and that can be good, but I think Hollywood, mainstream Hollywood, did not know what to do with him.
I think that seems accurate, and some of that may be about the time that he came up. So he began really appearing in films as sort of, it's the beginning of the end of the studio system. You end of World War II, and then a very, very slow decline through the 1950s and into the 60s. I get a sense almost that if he had been a little bit younger, and maybe had been in like his 30s in the 1960s, and that was when he was being pushed as this Hollywood star, he would have had better success, because he really does remind me of people like Jean-Paul Belmondo, who was in so many of Godard's films. He's good looking without being overpoweringly good looking. Like you say, he's not Cary Grant, he's not John Garfield, he's not Marlon Brando or Paul Newman or any of those guys, but he's got this interesting everyman face, and he could play a lot of different parts. I think that he would have been better off actually working more with directors like Lewis, someone like Ida Lupino, those lower grade films that actually have a lot of space for actors that look like normal people and that are very good at playing those parts. I wish that he had done more. I wish that some of those things panned out better. He was never going to be a matinee idol. And you look at him and you go, like, there's no way that he can be. And some of that's because he's a little weird, just in the way that he talks and the way that he presents himself. And that would have played, I think, a lot better in the 1960s than it does in the early part of the 50s.
Am I the only one that thinks that Ed Helms kind of is poised to play him in a biopic one day? They have a very similar look. I kept watching this movie thinking, yeah,
Ed Helms.
It's very weird. If Ed Helms is listening, I'm just giving modern actors their Oscars for telling them they look vaguely like old Hollywood stars. Overall, what do we think about Gone Crazy and John Dahl in general between the two films? I think Lauren summed up John Dahl, at least. What did you think about the movie overall? What are final thoughts do you have to impart to everybody who might be on the fence about this?
Go watch the movie. It's fascinating. Even if the only reason that you watch it is to see the way that Lewis uses the camera in that extended take where he's actually filming over the back of the seat, it is fascinating. As anyone who loves cinema just should watch that, because he does it so well, it works so well, and it's a really interesting technique being used in B-noir. That's very cool, and it's an interesting film at worst. And at best, I mean, I love it. I think that it's awesome. I think that, like, the ending is great, the two lead actors are great. It's got that very 1950s, the sort of ancillary characters who are there to impart the moralism of the story, but the center of it really is just this intense, nasty, fatalistic relationship.
This is worth watching because it's a very different type of noir. If you're used to the A-level noirs, you need to check out some of the Bs, because they were far more adept at conveying naturalism and sexuality and violence in a way that I think A-level noirs were hindered by with the code. And I think Peggy Cummins is fantastic. I think John Dahl's really good. I don't think this is as good as his performance in Rope. It's probably wrong to compare the two because they're so different, but I think I liked him better in Rope than I did here. But I definitely think it's been good to watch both of those movies and get an appreciation for him, because those two movies are so iconic in the grand scheme of things, just for the controversy they evoke. This and Rope were very controversial. He's worth looking at, and worth looking at some of his movies. There's, of course, other ones that we didn't talk about, but those are the two I definitely say you should get a good overview. And Ed Helms, he could play the character. I'm just throwing that out there. Listeners, you can send me your thoughts about Rope, Gone Crazy, John Dahl, Ed Helms. I don't care. I'll read them on the podcast. You can email them to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com or tweet them to me at ticklish_biz with the hashtag Centennial Celebration, and I will read them online. Once again, I'd like to thank Lauren Humphreys Brooks for joining me all month to talk about John Dahl, and as well as to talk about Ida Lupino. She was here back in January. We'll see Lauren again during the Centennial Celebration, I believe. She will be back at some point. We all know this. But Lauren, where can fans read more of your stuff, see more of your stuff? Where can they get in touch with you online?
You can get in touch with me on Twitter at LHBusiness. I've also got my own little film blog that I basically write whatever I feel like. Suddenlyashotrangout.com. And of course, I am on the Citizen Dame podcast and on the Citizen Dame website with Kristen.
That's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of different ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio and Player FM, or on iTunes. If you listen via iTunes, please consider helping the podcast out by leaving a rating or review. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, @gmail.com, or visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz. Want to learn more about upcoming episodes or hear exclusive content before anyone else? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the premier classic film podcast. Right now, patrons can hear my interview with Michael Curtiz biographer Alan K. Rohde. I'll also be putting up my TCM Classic Film Festival audio over the coming weeks. And patrons can also learn right now about the two spin-off series I'm creating exclusively for Patreon subscribers. Also, anyone who becomes a patron in the month of May is eligible for a secret prize pack from the Ticklish Biz Vault. Now, I understand May is almost over, and let's just say we're going to continue that into June. I swear, I will give something away at some point. Want to learn more about the stars turning 100 this year? Well, if you're a member of TCM's exclusive fan club TCM Backlot, you can read my year-long series about the stars highlighted here, discussing films and information that you won't hear on the podcast. Next time, things are heating up as we devote the month of June to actress Rita Hayworth. Guest Nell Manow joins me as we kick off our Hayworth tribute discussing 1946's Gilda. Till then.